All right. What do I want to talk about? What do I want to talk about? Hello, everybody. Welcome to a little bit of time that I have to chat with you all, which is a great, deep, and wonderful pleasure in my life. And thank you so much for joining. Thank you so much for your support of philosophy at freedomain.com/donate. But enough of the donation requests. If you have questions, comments, issues, challenges, problems, disagreements, whatever you like, I certainly have some thoughts which I would like to share. But if we have eager requirements for anything that I can be of use for, please raise your hand and request. I can, of course, simply chat and go from there. So I'll just wait for a second in case anybody's got a yearning burning that doesn't require a doctor and a shot. We can do a brain and a chat. A brain and a chat. All right. So just while I wait for sort of people to come up, as a bit, you know, never complain, never explain. Like, I get all of that, and I sympathize with that. But let me tell you, my friends, people seem to misunderstand this a lot, so I'll speak on it once, and then forever hold my peace. And it goes a little something like this. So let's say that I have, I don't know, what is it, 420,000 followers or whatever, right? And, you know, it's been going pretty well, and of course, thanks to everyone for supporting and sharing what it is that I do. And so having a big follower count, I mean, it's not that big, right? It's not big, not tiny, it's not that big. But let's say having a medium-sized follower count does not have me win any arguments except how to have a medium-sized follower count. Right? You follow? So when people say to me, Steph, you need to do this, that, or the other on X, well, I'm curious, and I will go, and I will have a look at that person's account. And someone had a couple hundred followers. One guy who'd been around for a long time had 4,100 followers. Now, I don't care, 4,100 followers, maybe that's your thing, maybe it's a tight group of quality people, but not tighter and more quality than this group of people. But I don't care that you have a small following. It doesn't mean that you're right or wrong about anything. Except how to be effective on X. That is the one grand exception. So for instance, if you are 300 pounds and you're telling me about quantum physics, I don't get to say, well, you're wrong because you're 300 pounds. But if you tell me, Steph, dieting is really important, being a healthy weight is really important, and I have the best diet, and I know the best how to lose weight, I'm going to say, but you're 300 pounds. So where there is a congruence or a match between what you're telling other people to do and what you clearly haven't done, that's going to be taken note of. I mean, I'm bald. And if I'm talking to you about philosophy, the fact that I'm bald is immaterial. Solar-powered sex machine, not solar-powered thought machine. However, if I'm trying to sell hair restoration products and I'm bald, people are going to say, but you're bald. Now, it's not an ad hominem, to say to me, you're bald, if what I'm doing is trying to sell or hawk hair restoration products. Because if it's really important to restore your hair, and I know exactly how to do it, and it's safe, why wouldn't I have done it? So it's an ad hominem to say, Steph, you're wrong about morals because you're bald. That's an ad hominem, sure. But when it's directly related to what it is that you're talking about, sure. Of course we judge a book by its cover. Of course we do. We judge a diet book by the person who's on the cover. And if the person who's on the cover of a diet book is 300 pounds, we don't buy it. Ah, Steph, but logically, come on, let's all be reasonable about this. Somebody who's trying to sell you makeup, right? The model who's trying to sell you makeup isn't going to have crappy skin. Someone who's trying to sell you hair care products isn't going to have crappy hair. And so when people come on X and they say to me, Steph, you need to do this, that, or the other on social media. Hey, okay, fine. but then they better have a good follow account. And I have, of course, taken advice over the years from people with big follow accounts, and that advice has been very helpful. But when someone comes at me kind of snarky about what I should or shouldn't be doing to be effective and to increase my reach on social media, of course I'm going to go and look at their follow account. And the reason why this is important is that if we don't push that there is expertise, we end up with socialism. Oh, does that sound like a stretch? It might, but give me a moment and I will tell you what I mean. So when you really understand how good people are at some things, then you'll understand why they're very popular, why they have a big follower count, why they make money, why their albums sell and other people's albums don't sell, and so on, right? So a classic example, of course, is what's considered by some the best live performance in history, which is Queen at Live Aid. And if I, you know, occasionally I'll do karaoke and occasionally I'll get some applause. Yeah, you know, whatever, right? I'm a decent amateur, okay singer, whatever, right? And I like to perform. So I go to karaoke and I think once or twice, two or three times I've actually sung in front of people in a more formal event. And it's all good-natured, goofy fun. I'm not much of a vocalist, but I enjoy doing it. And people seem to enjoy the passion, if not necessarily the expertise. So if I'm reasonably well received at karaoke, I don't go up and lecture Freddie Mercury on how to perform in front of people, because Freddie Mercury has performed in front of 300,000 people in Brazil. Well, Queen as a whole, but Freddie Mercury's the front man. It's not like anyone's looking at John Deacon, right? So I might tell Freddie Mercury, if he was still alive, here's some expertise I have in the realm of philosophy if he was interested, but I'm not going to tell the guy how to perform, because that would be an idiotic thing to do. Now, of course, I'm taking extreme examples just to sort of reinforce the point. I'm a reasonably decent chess player. But I'm not going to go up to a grandmaster and tell him how to play. Because it's ridiculous. And it's really important to push back on this kind of vanity in people. And if it's any consolation, it's also good to push back against this kind of vanity in ourselves. This arrogance, because, you know, we're all the main players in our movies and so on. And maybe this is a British thing. Could be. I spent my formative years in England. I saw all the different classes because I was in a really kind of broke-ass rent-controlled apartment, a flat. And then I also went to boarding school for a couple of years and mixed with the hoity-toities. That was sort of funded by my father and then not funded by my father. But anyway, so I grew up in England, and in England, embarrassment is, you know, this is what the word cringe, you know, it's cringe where it comes out of. And cringe is sort of an NPC control word for the most part. But the idea that I would go and lecture someone who was much better at something than I was would be horribly embarrassing. And it would also indicate what's called the Dunning-Kruger effect. The Dunning-Kruger effect is if you're not good at something, it's hard for you to recognize how good someone is. So, for instance, I know almost nothing about surgery. So, if I'm watching someone perform a surgery, I really have no idea how good or bad they are because I don't know what's going on. I don't know if they should be cutting there. I don't know if that was a good or bad cut. I don't know if it's a good or bad sew-up. I don't know if they got everything they needed to. I don't know because I don't know much about surgery. So I don't know who's good or bad at surgery. So I don't try to figure that stuff out. I just sit back and, I don't watch surgery because I don't really know much about it. When I first came to Canada, and I didn't grow up with ice hockey or anything like that. So when I first came to Canada, I watched hockey. And I'd be like, what do you mean icing? It's all ice, right? I mean, there's still things I don't particularly understand about American football or basketball. These are two sports I've never really played. And I don't really, I mean, I can give you all the finer points of tennis and stuff, cricket, I guess, even still, but I just don't know. But so I'm not going to judge because I don't know. And it's important to assert your expertise in life and to recognize other people's expertise. So Mike Cernovich is like great at posting and engagement. He walks a great line that, you know, you could say I didn't or whatever, right? It's different choices. I'm not going to go to Mike Cernovich and say to him, hey, you need to do X, Y, and Z, right? Even though, you know, I don't know how much, he's got two or three times my follow account now. Admittedly, I've been away for a while, but I mean, he's very good. Whatever you think of the content, I think the content's actually good, but he's really good at social media. Alex Jones, what did I see the other day? Alex Jones was having a live stream that had like 350,000 people watching, right? Am I going to go to Alex Jones and say, Well, Alex, you see, here's what you need to do to be more effective at live streaming. Oh, I mean, you know, I could talk to people about philosophy, but I don't go to people like objectively and demonstrably better or having a better effect than I've had in certain areas and lecture them on how to improve. So just so you know, right? I mean, it's not because I don't care about people's follow account. I care about their arguments. I don't care about the follow account. And somebody can be on X and not want to grow their follow account much at all. That's fine. But if somebody's going to tell me how to be good at social media and they have no followers, I'm going to say that's ridiculous. And that's important because when people think they're better than they are, or sort of stride around, cock of the walk, as we used to say, then that's abrasive and annoying. And what happens, of course, is that quality people don't want to spend time with them. I mean, come on, let's be honest, right? We've all had that friend, maybe we've been that friend, but we've all had that friend who, you know, from the comfort of their armchair, knows exactly how other people should do stuff better. Well, what he should have done is she should have done more calf work before going out on the field. Yeah, they shouldn't have tried that reggae sound, man. That sucked. I would have gone with country. You know, and these are people who haven't really achieved much of anything. There's an old, I remember this from when I was younger, and it sort of reminded me always of the scene in Atlas Shrugged. Hugh Axon's restaurant. Anyway, so, and I was always kind of terrified when I was younger, I might end up like this guy. And I'll get to your questions in just a sec. I'm almost done. I appreciate your patience. But there's a diner and there's a guy down at the end of the diner. He's kind of unshaven. He's kind of greasy haired. He's clutching a coffee, nursing a coffee, doesn't want to finish it because he maybe can't afford another one. And boy, oh boy, does he have the solution to all the world's problems. Whew, man, he's got it down. He has got it down. Any question that comes up, he's got an answer. To which, of course, some people might say, then why are you a greasy-haired guy in shabby old clothes sitting at the end of the diner unable to afford another cup of coffee? Assert your expertise in the things that you're good at. Do not let people encroach upon your territory of expertise. Do not encroach on other people's territory of expertise. And I was talking the other day, I was playing pickleball with some friends, and next to me at the court, we had a pickleball court, and then next to me was a tennis court, and on the tennis court were four guys staggeringly good at tennis. Like, holy crap. I mean, serves like a bullet, backhands that just soared over the net just perfectly, and the idea that I would go and lecture them about how to play tennis, I would die. I would die. I would melt into the ground. And don't encroach. I could learn from them. I can watch them and learn from them. But the idea I'm going to pump, well, you need to hold your racket this way. It's like, I don't encroach upon people's expertise. Yeah, have conversations with them, learn with them, enjoy what it is that they do. But my God. Oh. I mean, this used to happen sometimes when I was in the theater world, that people would just be bitching and moaning about some very successful actor. Oh, he's not that good. It's like, but he's successful. Yeah, but. It's like, well, it's like Arnold Schwarzenegger. Was he going to play Hamlet? No. I mean, he brings a certain persona and character to his character. It's like Brad Pitt now has become a kind of like a caricature of the Marlboro Man, right? So they're good at what they do. People want to see them, and they get to tell stories that other people don't to a much wider audience. And you have to assert your expertise, because if you don't assert your expertise, people don't understand why some people are more successful than others. And if they don't understand why some people are more successful than others, then they end up being socialists. All right. So I appreciate that. Thank you for your patience, Zach. You are on the air and in my ear. You'll need to unmute. What's on your mind, brother? Hello.
How are you?
I'm well. How you doing?
I'm really good, thank you. I'm really good. Long-term listener. I love the call-ins. It's great to see you on X. I was just thinking about what you were saying in terms of putting forward your expertise. I'm finding that in my field of work in IT, I'm getting lots of, staff inside organizations like graphic designers, doing our work. A lot of level one support requests are being handled by ChatGPT. Well, I basically feel like the industry is almost evaporating before my very eyes, but it is difficult when they have these tools to do their own troubleshooting, and then they tell you what you need to do, and it's that asserting my expertise. Like, no, you guys stick to graphic design and 3D animating, and I'll do what I do, which is take care of the computers and the security and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, can you imagine you run some complicated cross-border business with a whole bevy of lawyers and accountants, and you as the manager, you're going to argue with your lawyers and accountants? No.
No, I don't argue with my lawyer at all.
Yeah, I mean, my God, I'm just, okay.
You say jump, I say how high? Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so just this idea that am I going to argue with my dentist? I mean, I don't know, if my dentist keeps making me lose teeth, maybe I'll move dentist, but just having respect for expertise seems to be a thing, a gone, and I think it has a lot to do with the sort of feminization of youth that's going on, like just absolute cloying, and there's nothing wrong. Women are absolute cheerleaders, and that's great. If you've been around, I don't know if you have babies or kids or whatever, but, when your kid does the slightest little thing, the women are all like, yay, good job, well done, good job. And it's beautiful. It's beautiful. Oh, he learned to roll over. Yay, good. You caught the ball. Wow, you can roll the ball back to me. Beautiful. And they're just thrilled at every breathing, waking moment. And it's beautiful. And then about the age of 5, 6, 7, 8, somewhere in there, the kids are supposed to, especially the boys, they're supposed to be turned over to the men.
Right.
And what are the men supposed to do if the kid is bad at something? That's not good. That's really bad. Because everyone learns how to roll over. Everyone learns how to sit up. Everyone learns how to roll a ball back. Everyone learns how to feed themselves with a spoon, right? So the enthusiasm is fine. But after the basic skills are mastered, you split into people who are really good, people who are okay, and people who are bad. And men need to be the custodians and champions of that sorting process. You know, it's kind of funny how there's a sorting process in Harry Potter with the hat and all. That's completely random, right? So women are, boosters. I'm going to say mindless because it's appropriate to babies and toddlers. You want them to get excited about learning basic skills. But after the basic skills have been learned, yay, you made the letter A. Oh, that's great. But publishers have to be, you're not a good writer. Right? So, the first time your kid hits a ball with a bat, you're thrilled. Yay, great job. Wow. However, that's not how the Major League Baseball works. Major League Baseball is like, you suck. you're going down to the minor leagues, right?
So, Stefan, what age do you sort of see that where a boy in particular would be, you know, going from being, you know, under the mother's tit to being into, I thought that was from like 10 in the teenage years from my, yeah.
Well, traditionally, I'm sort of thinking about Judaism, 7 or so, or the age of reason about 7, the age of moral responsibility. It really depends, I suppose. I sort of said sort of 5 through 8, and it depends on the kid to some degree. It depends on whether it's a boy or a girl. But yeah, just this mindless boosterism. The male world is a raw meritocracy. The female world is enforced egalitarianism. And again, absolutely beautiful for both men and for women. We have, as together as a zygote team, we have created the greatest thing in the universe, which is the human mind. But yeah, it is always a shock when meritocracy is asserted. So when someone lectures me about something I'm good at and they're bad at, I need to tell them. It's unkind. It's unkind.
How do you like when you're in a consulting sort of IT provider, external party to a business, and you have that happening? What's a reasonable way to actually handle that situation where they are telling you how to suck eggs, and you say, "Well, hang on, you guys, I get paid either way. If you want to tell me how to do my job." You know, how would...
Okay, no, give me a, it's too abstract. Give me a more concrete example.
So this particular client, they're in growing pains. They've got about 6 staff. You know, they're on track to have about 100 staff. And that's sort of a turning point for some of these organizations going from a small business to a medium-sized business. And so, for example, they really, you know, they've got admin staff saving all their passwords in spreadsheets, and they've got graphic designers creating pretty Word documents for passwords where, you know, management are struggling to understand that they need to actually have a...
Okay, I don't want the laundry list of problems. Give me a particular problem where you get a pushback and you have expertise.
So they want to implement a system that was from 20 years ago that Microsoft had, and you needed to have on-prem equipment to use. Right. It's not something you would ever put in as a solution anymore. You would need to use the Microsoft cloud systems to utilize, and you'd need to add your license or organization, and it would go from, you'd almost triple your licensing costs just for one document to be protected. But because they were using ChatGPT and arguing with us about that, it became quite difficult to, like, they were fighting me because they were copying and pasting what our responses were into ChatGPT and saying, oh, no, you could just do it this way. Is that too...
Well, okay. So, I mean, the way that you would do that is you would you'd measure it, right? Okay, so copying and pasting takes 5 seconds times X number of employees times X number of people today, and this is the hourly rate, and this is their overhead, and you'd say, okay, this is costing you guys, $4.8 million a year. Right? No, so something like you have to slice and dice, right? And then you say, okay, but if you do it my way, it's $1 million a year, $3.8 million a year. If you've got the facts, I mean, they can't really argue the facts. Like, I've literally watched people do this. I've timed them, and I know how many times it happens, and so this is a bad solution. And if they fight back, then say, have you done this before? Have you done this kind of upgrade before? And if they say no, say, well, I have done 12 of them. So I have to benevolently assert my expertise. I understand it's tough because, you know, when you're a small entrepreneur, you do everything yourself and you do everything better than everyone else in general, right? And right. So, you know, I understand it's tough for you to recognize that somebody else might be better at something. I understand that. I sympathize and I get it, but it's true. And so, you know, part of growing a business is surrendering to other people's expertise, because as a founder, you might be able to do just about everything in a 5-person shop or even a 10-person shop, but 30, 50, 80, 100, like I've grown a company from me and a guy to like 35 people. So, you know, not major entrepreneur stuff, but not bad. And so if people haven't done it before, just say, I am the expert. Here are the numbers. I've done it 12 times. You haven't done it once. And I've also seen people who can't let go of control and trust other people's expertise, it cripples the company because people can't grow. And if you're a control freak, so to speak, or if you've got your finger in every pie, competent people don't want you nagging them and looking over their shoulders. So it's not even trust me, bro. It's like, I've got the numbers. I've got the history. This is exactly what you're paying for. Take the expertise.
Wow. Yeah, that's awesome. Awesome.
All right. Well, listen, I appreciate your call. And thank you so much for dropping by. I'm going to have some cool stuff to talk about on X shortly. And you're welcome, of course, anytime. And I wish you the best. All right. Stev. What's on your mind, friend?
Oh, was that me?
Sorry. Yes. Unless there's another Stev in your left pocket. Go ahead.
Hey, guys, I just jumped in. I didn't hear too much of the conversation, but...
That's you can talk about whatever you want. You don't have to talk about my lead. That's just a benevolent filler. Go ahead.
All right. I definitely have something I want to tell others. Oh, it was great to see you on X again, Stefan. I remember you got shadow banned, and then I saw your post randomly in my feed. I'm like, holy shit, Stefan's on Twitter again.
He's done pulled a Lazarus. Anyway, I guess that would make Elon Jesus. But go ahead.
Yeah, well, welcome back. I love your content. And it's also one of the reasons why I got into crypto. I work full-time in absolute crypto, not now, mostly on the technology side. But I encourage everyone to watch Stefan's presentation, Bitcoin versus Political Power, the Cryptocurrency Revolution. That was a very inspirational presentation for me. So that's my crypto origin story. So
thank you. I appreciate that.
To watch that. And ever since then too, you know, in crypto, it gets really saturated with people who are, you know, like wind, moon, and all this other stuff. But,
I'm sorry, what? Wind, moon? What do you mean? What does that mean?
Oh, wind, moon. Like when is my meme token going to price appreciate?
Sorry. So win money and when the thing goes to the moon. Okay, I'm sorry. I thought you said win moon. I'm like, earth, wind, and fire are in crypto? Okay.
Honestly, I have to use Urban Dictionary sometimes when I see some of these acronyms, the crypto.
Remember, it's been a while for me. But anyway, what's on your mind?
Yeah, not much. I would just say, you know, people check that out because the crypto market has grown a lot. It'll be nice if we have people who still care about the values of Bitcoin, because I know Stefan, you said something that I kind of agree with. Where you said capitalism kind of like two things, where it's like very, very simplified too, because people construe things with capitalism which aren't really capitalistic, like the Federal Reserve Bank and a lot of the systems that exist now, but. You know, I think he said capitalism was two things, where it was like private property and enforcement of contracts, or in other words, you know, just keep your promises and, you know, don't invade my home. And I feel like that's kind of, I feel like if Bitcoin did not have those values, where, hey, not your keys, not your coins, or when it comes to programmable chains, that's where you kind of get to realize, you know, keep your promises, recap, trust, minimize contract enforcement and stuff. But, that's why I'm here in this industry, and I think it's hard to explain the values of crypto sometimes, and what else? Yeah, it's hard to explain those values. I feel like if Bitcoin didn't have those values at all, no one would find it valuable.
Right.
It needed, or even when it comes to smart contract programmable chains, if you. You know, the value is to keep your promises in a trust minimized way. Like, hey, I don't need the government with a bunch of guns to trigger this value exchange, for example, when a certain event is met. But I always found that incredible, and I always encourage people to recognize the value of crypto. And in a way, it's kind of like a capitalistic. I don't know that those two principles of cap, like the capitalism you mentioned a while ago, was just private property enforcement of contracts. I feel like that's why kind of the whole blockchain industry exists and has a value to offer in the first place. Like Bitcoin was just inflationary nonsense ran by one guy. People wouldn't find it as a store of values today.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And for those, of course, who want to get into Bitcoin, there's lots of great people who are talking about it, Michael Saylor, Andreas Antonopoulos, and lots of other great people. And of course, I did a presentation. I did original presentation on Bitcoin 2014, and I updated it last year. So I hope people will check that out. And thank you so much for dropping by. Congratulations on getting into a very cool industry. All right, short and long, what's on your mind? I'm all ears.
Oh, okay. Steph, wow, this is amazing. I can't believe I'm finally speaking to you.
Believe it.
I've been watching. I just want to say I've been watching you ever since you had a formal debate with this man who made the Zeitgeist movies.
Oh, Peter Joseph.
Peter Joseph, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I've been watching you ever since then.
That's cool. That's very cool. I appreciate that. So what's on your mind?
I just wonder if there's any, I mean, like, have you seen the, what happened in Britain with children being, aborted at any time in the pregnancy?
Yeah. Yeah. Up to birth, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Up to birth.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's crazy. So, I mean, what do you think that people should do from there? Because obviously that's pure evil, right?
I mean, I was a little bit uneasy when people say, like, what should people do? I mean, it sounds like almost sinister, if that makes sense. It sounds almost sinister. I'm not saying that's you. I'm just saying that there is that sort of aspect to it. So as far as what people should do, I think just have a conversation. Have a conversation about this as a whole. And, you know, if you look at America, since Roe v. Wade, which was largely a scam operation of the woman who was originally the abortion test case turned against it, was lied to, and so on. So it was a bit of a scam, that whole thing. But 62 million babies.
I know, it's sick.
Like six, this is like 10 plus Holocaust. This is more than a World War II and a half. That is, you know, that is six World War Ones. Now, I get it's not quite the same as taking an adult and blowing them up with shrapnel or mustard gassing their lung sacs, but that is a lot of not people. That is a lot of not people. Go ahead, sorry.
So, like, isn't it though, right? When we're talking about killing a life inside, whether it's inside of a mother or not.
No, I'm sorry. And I was unclear about that. So let me revisit what I said. So what I mean is that it's not vivid for people.
It's not exactly.
It's a quiet little suction in a back room or whatever it is going to be, right? And it's a disposal and a recycling and it's not like a guy getting blown up or gunned down or hanging off razor wire or something right. like that. It's a quiet, silent slaughter, so to speak, and it's not vivid and it's not dramatic. And it is something that, and again, I'm not trying to put all women into one giant lump of estrogenical sameness, or estrogen sameness, but what I will say is that, boy, oh boy, does that seem to be, I mean, it is recorded in America as women's number one concern, access to abortion. It is the biggest thing in the universe. Sorry, go ahead.
And it's just kind of like, why, you know, like, why is that your number one concern? I would put it as if you're not in any sort of danger from being pregnant in the first place, and you know, you are one of those women who gets a pregnancy, who gets an abortion just because of the fact that it's inconvenient to your life. Like, why is that the main concern amongst most women? It's 40%. You know what I mean? Which is almost half, which is ghoulish.
Sorry, 40% is referring to, is that the 40% to whom it is the number one 40% of women?
Yes, exactly.
Well, would you like the answer? I would hesitate if I were in your shoes to say, well, it's an inconvenience. Like a human life and a baby is more than an inconvenience if you want to raise the kid well. So I can tell you why I think that. Oh, yeah, it's more than an inconvenience. I mean, I've been a stay-at-home dad. I mean, it changes your whole life. I didn't write books for 10 years because I was busy raising my daughter, right? It's more than just like, oh, man, I left my phone at the dry cleaner, so I'll have to go back. That's an inconvenience.
You know, it's a major responsibility.
Yeah, massive. It's the biggest thing that can happen. Yeah, it's the biggest thing that can happen in your life, and it's more time-consuming than any other single thing you'll do outside of work. Sorry, you were going to say?
I guess I have a different perspective on it, just because I would love to have a child. Me and my wife have had 2 miscarriages so far.
Oh, I'm so sorry. And isn't it awful when you're desperate to try and have a child watching 2 things? People get abortions and people be terrible parents, or people not even trying to become parents. Yeah. No, it's horrible. It's horrible. Well, I can break out the mystery, if you like, and I can tell you why some women, or a lot of women, are so concerned about abortion. And I think, and there's a lot of reasons, but I'm the philosophy guy, so I've got to try and boil it down to just a few. So one of the most important ones is lust. Now, in the past, women would not provide sex until marriage. At least that was generally the ideal. And if you were found to be having sex before marriage, you would get a shotgun wedding and so on, like 30% of 19th century Wild West weddings, like you can tell from the date of birth that the woman was already pregnant. So if abortion is off the table, and by I'm not talking about medical emergencies, life of the mother, I'm talking about, you know, the 97 or 95% or 90% of what women choose abortion for, which is, it's just, there's no incest, there's no rape, there's no medical necessity. It's just a choice. It's a choice. So if you take that off the table, then women have to focus their lust on men who will be good providers and husbands, and most importantly, fathers for their children. They don't get to straddle the tattooed motorcycle guy with the lopsided grin and the chiseled jaw and the steel blue eyes, right, who's exciting for them, right? And I understand that. I mean, it's like the hot crazy matrix works the other way, hot stable matrix for guys as a whole. So they have to say, okay, look, there's lust, and then there's what's best for myself, my family, my children, and my future. And it's the same thing with guys. There's some hot to trot girl, you know, maybe she's kind of unstable, and, you know, for a lot of guys, unstable women are great in bed because they kind of have to compensate for their personalities. And you have to say, whoa, hang on. I don't want to get dick napped here. I'm going to have to really think with the big head. So if you say to women, if you get pregnant, then what? Right? So the whole problem, of course, and the reason for why we have these big brains is because children take forever to raise, right? I mean, I don't know if you've seen these videos, like a baby horse, a foal, is born and can stagger and walk around within a couple of hours or a day or two at most. Human beings take over, human beings take over a year to learn how to walk. Our brains don't hit full maturity, females early 20s, males mid-20s. I've heard some arguments about that, but that's sort of the last data that I saw that was really credible. That's a quarter century. It's insane. How long? But, you know, that which is more complex takes the longest to develop. So the human brain is the most complex thing. It takes the longest to develop. Now, if you say to women, you can't have an abortion, then they are really nervous about having sex. And that interferes with lust. Right? It would be like if there was a magic pill and you could eat anything you wanted. And if you gained weight, you took a pill, and all of your excess weight was gone, would have a huge effect on your eating, wouldn't it? You'd eat whatever you want because there was a magic pill that could take away all the negative effects of bad eating. And abortion is a magic procedure that takes all the negative effects away from irresponsible sex, which means you better start getting bloody responsible. And then the issue is, you know, one of the reasons why women offer up sex instead of virtues, because they say, oh, I want an alpha. Oh, I wanted this and that and the other. It's like, yeah, okay. So let's say that the alpha is a guy of, you know, high intelligence and ambition and success and motivation, all these kinds of things, right? Well, if you want to have more than just sex with an alpha male, you have to be an alpha female, which means you have to be well-read, you have to be presentable, you have to be positive in his business associations, you have to be the kind of woman that other men are going to envy, because, you know, men work on status and their wives have a lot to do with that status. So if you want to have sex with an alpha male, traditionally you had to be an alpha female, right? You can't be really overweight, you can't have a lot of tattoos, you can't have face piercings, you can't have weird hair, you can't have, you know, even like, obviously, fake boobs. I know the Jeff Bezos thing or whatever, right? But you have to be kind of classy and you have to be well-read. You have to be able to hold a good conversation. You have to be able to run a great dinner party and you have to be a really great homemaker and all of that kind of stuff, right? So if you want, as a woman, to bed an alpha male, you have to be an alpha female. And the bedding, if it's going to occur, going to bed together, is going to happen on the way to the altar. But women want sex with the alpha males, but they don't want to bring alpha quality. So all they do is they bring sex to the table, and then they can, you know, a woman who's a 6 can get an 8, a woman who's a 7 can get a 10, only on the basis of sex, not on the basis of any permanent arrangement, right? So last thing I'll say is that women are as subject, maybe not quite as much, but quite a bit subject to the same principles and disastrous and temptations of lust. And if you say to women, you can only have sex with men who'll be good fathers, well, they then have to be good mothers, because men who are good fathers are looking for women who are good mothers, and more than just a set of spread legs and a nod. They're looking for moral qualities, not just a place to dump their semen. And so do women feel confident enough that they are bringing moral qualities to the table to the point where they can win over and keep a quality man, a quality father, a quality provider, and a quality husband? Well, if you take abortion away, women have to become, again, not all women, of course, right? But if you take abortion away, then women can't subsidize sexual activity with sex. They actually have to get commitment from a quality man. And that's really alarming for a lot of women, because sexuality is a kind of drug and male attention is a kind of drug. And keeping the love of a virtuous person is a whole lot harder than gaining the sperm of an unstable man. So I would say that has a lot to do with it, but I'm certainly happy to hear your thoughts as well.
Well, yes. I was going to go into something else, but I had a different thought. How much of accountability do you think that the atheistic sphere has had in the collapse of the West and in bringing us to this point where we are seeing this heinous abortion law and these the amoral facet of, you know, regular everyday people?
Well,
that has birthed this, you know, want and need for attention of men by women, and you know, just the 18 million men who have an OnlyFans subscription, and the 10% of 18 to 24 year olds who have an OnlyFans account, women who have an OnlyFans account.
Yeah. Well, it's not small in that, of course, for...
I would say 90%.
Sorry, what's 90%?
The contribution of the atheistic sphere to what we have going on now.
Right. Now, it's not small, of course, because as you probably know even better than I do, Christianity says that life begins at conception and the soul is in the body, and murdering the fetus is killing a human being, right? So that's the answer. Now, The church, though, and I'm going to use just this big nomenclature church, although I recognize that there's a lot of denominations, but I'm just going to say the church in the West as a whole, so Christianity as a whole, the church faced a massive challenge, of course, starting in the 16th, 17th century. I'm not really talking about the Reformation or the Protestant fragmentation of Christendom. I'm talking about science. So the church had been in control of human progress for, 1500 years. I'm just going to give a nice millennia and a half, although, of course, it's arguable on the fringes, right? And the church, I'm just talking about the West, so just bear with me, right? So the church faced the fact that science was contributing far more to the alleviation of human suffering and the progress of the human spirit than the church had maintained. And I know it's unfair to say, well, just the Dark Ages, and I get there with the Saracen harassings and 2 million Europeans were taken into slavery by Muslims and all kinds of terrible stuff. And there was the collapse of the Roman Empire. And then, of course, in the early Middle Ages, you got hit with successive waves of the Black Death. Thanks, China. It's long like that's the last time that's going to happen.
Which, of course, people, conveniently forget about the Saracen.
Yes. And in fact, not even many people know that Saracen is the same as Muslim. Anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
So the church faced a real competitor in two things. Number one, science. Number two, the free market. And science and the free market did not come out of the church. I'm not saying that the church was, Tom Wood schooled me on this some years back about how pro-science a lot of church elders were, but it did not fundamentally come out of the church science, and it did not, and neither did the free market. And science and the free market have been the two, and the free market by far the most, have been the greatest beneficiaries. I'm sure you've seen these graphs of like human income and wealth from like the dawn of history until 200 years ago. It's just flatlined and then goes through the roof. So the problem is that science, materialism, empiricism, and the free market combined to produce the greatest forward thrusting of human progress the planet has ever seen. And it's not even close. It wasn't even like we are tens of thousands of times wealthier than the people were when the church was in control.
Right.
So that is a big challenge. The way that I, of course, have tried to bridge that challenge is to say, well, given that the progress of science and the free market, and of course, 20th century medicine, given the benefits that that has all produced, which does not come out of the Bible, does not come out of Christianity directly, those benefits have delegitimized Christian virtues, Christian ethics. And by that, I don't mean that Christian ethics are delegitimized, but if you say, if you're a doctor, right, and you say, I've got the cures for what ails you, and you don't really cure that many people, or many people stay sick, and then some other doctor hangs up his shingle across from you, and he's healing, 10 or 100 or 1,000 times more people than you, your business is challenged. And I'm sorry to put it in such crass terms, but I just want to look at the general mechanics about these things. So when the church faced the overtaking and elevation of the human condition through science, the free market, and 20th century medicine, people were no longer in particular believing in the virtues and values of the church. Now, atheists then ditched morality to a large degree along with theology, and that is the demonic aspect of modern atheism, which I know personally because, of course, I came up with a rational proof of secular ethics, and I'm not a complete unknown. I was the biggest intellectual in the world by some measures for quite some time, and had good inroads within the atheist community and debated, and I debated atheists. UPB was debated. I debated atheists regarding UPB, my approach to ethics, and they hated it. They hated it more than Christians, which is an amazing thing to me. A rational proof of ethics was questioned and accepted, and Christians were interested in a curious and non-hostile fashion. But atheists just hated it. And it's like, okay, that's kind of demonic, bro.
Yeah, so, I think I remember.
So
that.
I think it has a lot to do. Yeah, I think it has a lot to do with, and certainly atheism has a lot to do with it. But the church, and I'm not sure exactly how, but the church needed to find a way to bring ethics into the realm of science, reason, and evidence. And the church was unable to do that, or unwilling to do that, perhaps due to the limitations of needing faith. But philosophy has to be the way forward. Materialism, right? The body without a soul has not worked. The soul without a body has not worked in focusing on the afterlife and faith and theology alone. It is my hope, of course, that philosophy can do the job that religion and amoral atheism has failed at. It is, of course, my goal to hope to step into the breach and heal this wound through which civilization is currently bleeding out, if that makes sense.
I think that that religion, well, okay, so let's see here. I think I heard you say it once long ago, years ago, 2015, something like that, that, you know, what atheism did was like pick out the philosophy of the church, but it left a vacuum because it left nothing there.
Well, it left a moral void.
Yeah, exactly. Which are a moral vacuum, exactly.
So religion is focused on the ought and science is focused on the is. And of course, as Hume has famously argued, you can't get an ought from an is, which you can't get morals from atoms. And so atheism just gave up on that. And Hume did a huge disservice. And I've obviously believed that I have solved the Humean is-ought dichotomy, which we don't have to get into right now. But when Hume became very popular as a Scottish philosopher, when Hume became very popular, so you can't get an ought from an is. Well, as society moved more from the ought of religion to the is of science, the study of matter and energy and the relationships thereon, well, the ought, the morals, the vision, the purpose all got lost. And people carved apart the universe looking for virtues could find none and then became amoral. And of course, it is my goal as a philosopher, again, to sort of heal that. Sorry, is there anything else? We got a whole whack of people. Is there anything else that you wanted to mention? Great questions, by the way. I really do appreciate you calling in.
No, of course. I just wanted to finish this up by saying that I've always wanted to speak to you. Especially when you were on YouTube and we were going through the whole migrant crisis thing. I remember, I think you did a speech by Winston Churchill. And yeah, I think you remember the video that I'm talking about.
I do.
it was impressive. I just remember that being that whole point being like such a pivotal part in society because of the fact that, I mean, like, and that's when you actually got taken off of YouTube, you and Lauren Southern, I think, as well as a few other people.
There was a lot going on.
Yeah, exactly. You and Red Ice Radio.
Well, I mean, for the banning too, because I was focusing on the human origins of COVID, that was a big deal. Because the reason why the lockdowns happened was because COVID was perceived to be of natural origin. If something is natural origin, it's only got a toehold in the infection of human beings, you can slow the spread. If something is engineered from the ground up to infect human beings, then there's no, absolutely zero point to lockdowns. There's no point to it whatsoever. So, all right. Well, listen, thanks very much. You're welcome to call back anytime. I really do appreciate the questions, and I hope I did them some justice in the short time that we had. Zach Attack. Unmute, my friend, and I'm all ears. Like a Dumbo.
Oh, thanks for having me back on.
Look, sorry, did we already talk or were you?
We did, but I sort of was just riffing on what you were sort of talking about in terms of the subject you were talking about, but could we talk about something else?
Sure. But keep it brief because I've got a bunch of people, so I apologize. You look familiar, but I have the memory span of your average goldfish. Sorry, go ahead.
Okay. So, I'm long, really long-term listener. So no mercy, all good. I got my doctor's results back last week because we're trying to have children and we did all the tests, blood tests and everything like that. It came back that my testosterone levels was half of what the minimum was needed to be. And it's just a gut punched.
Sorry, the minimum of what? You mean for sperm production or something?
Or the healthy range of test.
And your wife's FSH is good and there's no issues there?
No issues there, no.
Okay. All right. So you are low on the T?
Yes.
Okay.
And and I'm just more from your experience of what kind of effect that could have on me. Like we were talking about, you know, asserting my expertise with clients, you know, could some of these things, how could they present themselves in my day to day, or is it just, obviously I'm looking at how to correct the ONT.
I can only talk about, I mean, somebody doesn't really matter. Let's just call him Bob. And yeah, Bob had some anxiety. This is a guy I know. Bob had some anxiety. I think he went to go and get, I think it was DHEA or something like that, which I think is some sort of testosterone supplement. And he said that his anxiety lessened and so on. And I, of course, have always been aware that I really need to check my T levels and do what I can to keep it up, because it's really tough as a man to be assertive in the absence or the low part of testosterone. And again, none of this is any kind of medical or nutritional advice. This is all, I'm just, you know, I want to make sure that people don't think that I'm overstepping any expertise that I don't have. But yeah, I think it's worth getting checked. Obviously, you've got checked. And, you know, as far as things that you can do, obviously talk to a doctor or a nutritionist and get into the kind of things that will help. And I think you'll be quite surprised.
I've got a referral for that, for specialists and that sort of thing. Because the doctor sort of said it at like 31, it's quite low to have such low T. And I just wondered if it could be also environmental. Like, I didn't grow up with a father. I was raised by my grandmother and a single mother.
And it's funny because I have a memory of, and maybe with AI people can do this now, I have a memory of reading that being raised by a single mother lowers testosterone, and then I looked for it again some years later and I couldn't find any good confirmation. So we'll leave that. But I certainly think it doesn't help. I certainly think it does not help at all. So I think you'll be quite surprised at what you think of as your personality and how much it is dependent on things like hormones and testosterone levels and all of that. So I wish you the very best, and you know, drop me a line if you can, host@freedomain.com, and let me know how it's going forward and what worked for you.
I mean, my wife and I would really love to do a call-in show with you.
Oh, fantastic. Wait till your tea is up and then you can scream at me. All right. No, I appreciate that.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, man. I appreciate that. And Christopher, we got people cycling in and out of here like the Assyrian, up and down like the Assyrian empire. All right. Christopher, if you want to unmute, what is on your mind, my friend?
Hey, wow, this is surreal. It is a great honor to talk to you. Finally, I tried 10 years ago through your program. However, something got mixed up. I wasn't very good at articulating my problems. I'm your case example. I stumbled onto you because I was in a relationship with my wife, that ex-wife, that was the abusive thing, narcissist, typical profile. And I was like, but she had me convinced I was the problem. So I started listening to you with all your remarks about, you know, and it stems back. It folds out. Like, I can follow my whole family lineage to where, like, abuse is like the cycle and whatnot. So that was really insightful. And then it also got me seeing that I'm not the problem. I was programmed to be accept the problem. I also like the fact that you were like, it's okay to get rid of toxic people, even if it's your parents. I use that. I still talk to my mother. However, you know, it's tentative, but like the things you say were like, it woke me up, and I really wanted to thank you on that.
Yeah. And I appreciate that. And just sort of very, very briefly, I mean, it's wild to me that people think that the moral law somehow carves around parents. And when the moral law should most apply to parents, because they have the greatest power in your life when you were helpless and dependent. So when people say, well, but the moral law bends around parents, respect their mother and their father no matter what, it's like, but that's not how the law works. I mean, if a father, let's say that a father is the getaway driver for his 17-year-old son who's violently robbing a bank, do we say, well, we got to throw the 17 or 16-year-old kid in jail, but the father should get off scot-free? Heck, we might even give him a key to the city. We might give him a new Cadillac, right? Because he's the father. And it's like, no, we would actually be really even more upset at the father for drawing his still underage son into a life of crime. I mean, the law does not step around parents. In fact, the law holds parents to higher accountability. I don't go to jail if my neighbor doesn't feed his kid. But if the neighbor doesn't feed his kid, the neighbor goes to jail or at least receives some kind of visit or some kind of sanction. So there is a higher moral law for parents and the law and in society as a whole. And then when you talk about, well, if they're abusive, you don't have to spend time with them. If they won't change, if they won't grow, if they won't heal, if they won't respect your voice or your arguments, and then just people lose their minds. And yet the law, you know, it's like the old thing, well, separate families and migrants, illegal aliens to separate families. And as Tom Hoonan has pointed out, it's like, but that's all of the law. You know, some guy gets arrested for drunk driving, he goes to jail and the family is separated. So.
It's also an invisible shadow. It's a shadow on your life, because what it did is it messed with my program. So the reason I ended up with my ex is because I saw her as normal, because both my parents were abusive, physically and emotionally and the whole nine, but were instilling righteous values into me. Love, family, life is thicker than, or blood's thicker than water, church, religion, all this stuff. And I'm an audiovisual learner, so like reading is not my forte. But when I started listening to audiobooks and podcasts, in fact, that's how I stumbled on you. Is I was a truck driver, and so I've listened to a lot of your content, lots and lots of hours, probably unhealthy amounts of hours, or healthy.
Unthinkable. There is only health, and the more the better. Anyway, sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. It's just that, you know, it is what it is, but. So I landed into the relationship, and then this happened, whatever. And then I ended up with my abusive father, and now he's dead, and then I'm in new situations. It's like a glorious little stew of nicety, but I'm working through it. I'm looking at all this garbage as a new way to come up with this new concept of this grassroots program I call Roots, and I'm working on that diligently. Of course, I'm way backwards in time because, you know, I was a truck driver 12 years and I was a computer technician at one time. And so I knew all this stuff like the back of my hand, but now I'm having to pick it up. And it's a little bit more difficult than riding a bicycle because you're like, oh God, what is all these? Like, I'm learning this. Well, what was Twitter, now X. And it's like, well, how's it, how to navigate and all that stuff. So I'm learning.
And, appreciate that update. What happened with your parents? You said physically and verbally. What did they do when you were a kid?
So I was the oldest of four younger brothers, and I was basically I suffered from what you call Peter Pan syndrome. I was a parent before I ever was a child, and then when I was
hang on. What does that mean? You mean you took care of your brothers, or you had a...
Yeah. So they'd be gone doing odd jobs, and we lived off welfare, all this stuff. So they'd be doing odd jobs and whatever. Of course, when I got to age, then I'd help out. So I learned scrap metaling. I was working since I was like 7, 8 years old, like doing stuff. I mean, I'm from the time, you know, back when toys were made out of metal. So...
Lawn darts. Taking out the week. Yeah.
So like, you know, our fun times were, you know, throwing rocks at each other and their grenades or whatever, but... Oh, yeah. So good times. Your playgrounds were made out of steel in the hot sun. Great times. Went to that, but there was, you know, I mean, excessive spanking. The verbal thing was more of a complacency thing. It wasn't necessarily like a, you're no good. You're no. It was more like I got eyes behind my head, like this totalitarian type.
Yeah, I don't know. We had some kind of hiccup. So sorry, you were just saying that you were a parent before you were even an adult, and we were talking about your early work and so on.
Yeah. So basically, I've been working since I was 8. I got strong work ethic. I've always had that and whatnot, but I had a frailty because I didn't recognize evil people because I was raised by evil people. So I ended up with an evil person that was trying to tell me I was the problem. But, you know, like I said, thanks to your help, I actually was able to, you know, walk the minefield. And it wasn't easy. It was not easy at all.
Right. Well, and what's your love life like at the moment?
Oh, it's absolutely horrible. I'm currently dealing with the great thing of property tax issues because my dad didn't pay taxes for the past 3 years. I own the house.
Wait, love life. Love life. What's your property taxes got to do with your love life?
Oh, my love life.
If I misspoke, sorry.
I have no, I got divorced 5 years ago.
Right. And how's your love life at the moment?
None. Non-existent. I'm, my love.
Why non-existent?
Because I'm more into purpose rather than relationship.
Okay.
I'm trying to build.
Do you want to have kids?
I already have a child.
More. Sorry.
No, I'm too old for that.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm going to be 49 this year. So that wouldn't be fair to the kid. I could not do that to someone, you know.
Okay, got it.
So that's out of the deck. Yeah, no, I'm not looking for that.
Right. Okay. Well, listen, I appreciate the update. I'm really sorry about what happened to you as a kid, but I'm really thrilled that you have come out of it. My pleasure, man. All the best. Thanks, man.
All right, bye.
James N. Well, that is a formal LinkedIn with a tie and everything profile, man. I feel I should explain to you what my 5-year plans are and why I left my last job. James, you're up.
Oh, I'm up. No way. Hey, it's I can't believe I got up. Hey, it's a pleasure. I wanted to ask, I know you're into the philosophy stuff, but are you still in Canada? And given Canada Day is tomorrow, your thoughts on like where the country's heading? I'm quite black-pilled as of late with the direction of the country. But yeah, just nice to have you back. So I wanted to ask that question to you.
Yeah, I mean, I hear what you're saying. I'm a free will guy, so I try not to make predictions about absolutes. Certainly the trends are not great, for sure, to put it mildly. But you never know when someone's going to make a great speech, someone's going to wake people up. You never know when there's going to be a sort of collective awakening. I mean, who would have guessed that the trucker convoy protests over COVID was really just about the most effective protests that have ever been staged outside of perhaps the American Revolution. And yeah, I mean, so who would have guessed? I wouldn't have guessed that in particular, that was going to occur. So yeah, I mean, I try not to, I'll tell you my basic.
Sorry, yeah, when those protests happened, it like rekindled my like desire to stay here. Prior to, I was ready to go.
Well, and going ain't easy, man. Leaving home ain't easy. So I'll tell you my basic philosophy of this. Love to hear your thoughts on it. And I'll keep mine brief because it's supposed to be a combo, right? So my basic philosophy goes something like this. I try not to look down the road too much. I try not to figure out general trends too much. What I try to do is do as much good as I can every day, because that's the maximum I can do. I don't know that staring down 5 years, 10 years, what's it going to be like, other than, you know, general prep for life as a whole. I don't know that that's going to add to the good that I can do every day. So I talk to people online. I talk to people in person. I exchange ideas and arguments. I have a loving family. I parent, I think, fairly well. And so this is the good that I can do in the time that I have. Now, If I do the maximum good, I mean, however you would measure that, I think it's, you know, you got to pace yourself, right? So if I do the maximum good that I can with the time that I have, everything else is outside of my control. So I try not to sort of look at long-term trends and where's this going to go and what's going to happen. First of all, that nobody knows. And secondly, it can produce a kind of dread, or, you know, the doom scrolling, they call it, sort of paralyzing anxiety or what's going to happen with this or what's going to happen with that. And then if you have a negative experience from looking ahead and thinking it all just goes downhill, then that reduces the amount of good that you can do in the day. So I ration negative news for sure. And I ration my inevitable desire, which we all have, to try and predict where the world is in 5 years or 10 years. I mean, nobody would have predicted AI. AI is going to transform so much in the world. And so I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't have guessed, of course, a couple of years ago that Elon Musk was going to buy Twitter and restore my account. I don't know. I didn't know these things. So I just aim to sort of keep my head down, do the maximum good I can on a day-to-day basis. And outside of that, I suppose you could say it's in God's, the collective's, or the universe's hands, if that makes sense.
No, it makes total sense. Like, you can only really change in your locale or implement, you know, goodwill in your immediate, like, family, you know, colleagues, associates, etc. Like, the idea that we can just change the world's, like, naive. No, it makes sense. The one thing, that little shining light, is I was very pleased to see a lot of young men finally get engaged in the political arena, and young men are just young people being majority conservative between the three parties, the two left-wing parties and then the cons. So I do have some hope, but man, we gotta get these boomers off CVC. I don't know what to do. But it's great to have it's great to have you.
Well, thanks, man. I appreciate that. And certainly the young people are, especially the young men, are giving us, I think, all a lot of hope. All right.
Yeah. So does this mean you're back or not? Are you back actually posting him next? Yeah, I won't be long. Are you back? Are you doing stuff again or what?
I'm not sure what your question is. I mean, we're talking on X and you're asking me if I'm back on X. What does this mean? Help me riddle this.
I just haven't seen you. And no, I've always loved your content in the past.
Well, I was banned.
Well, welcome back, dude.
And then there was a while where I was mulling over coming back, and my daughter made a good case, so I'm back. But yes, if I'm back on Twitter and I'm posting and hosting live spaces, it's fairly safe to assume that I'm back. I'm with you on that.
No, all I want to say is, like, I really enjoyed your content in the past, and welcome back. And yeah, man. And thanks for all the good thoughts.
Well, I appreciate that. And thank you for coming back, and thank you for holding your breath the whole time that I was gone. I'm sure it must be quite a relief.
I'm interested in reading the online version of a future book. I wasn't sure if you just want to kind of talk about that a bit, or...
I'm sorry, you were garbling quite a bit there. You said that you were interested in my novel, The Future?
For sure, yeah. Like, I've listened to pretty much all of your audiobooks. I have read your physical version of Almost and many other ones, but I was just wondering if you wanted to talk about The Future, because it seems like you like that book, or... But it's,
I do
it
like
also
that
seems
book.
It might help me. So what's that?
I do like that book. So yeah. So just for those of you who don't know, I write a bunch of nonfiction books, and I've written a bunch of fiction books. There is Just Poor. There is Revolutions. There is The God of Atheists. There is Almost. And then there are two novels that I wrote over the last couple of years in exile, so to speak, which was a novel called The Future, which is a science fiction book set 500 years in the future about a truly free society. And also a book called The Present, which is, as society begins to collapse, how people handle it and what they do, both morally and philosophically. So all of those books are available for free at freedomain.com/books, and I hope you will check them out. My favorite in many ways is Almost, but I do like The Future as well. So yeah, I'm all ears. What do you want to talk about with that?
Oh, absolutely. That book, Almost, holy crap, that was a great book for me. It was hard for me to read, I'll admit that, but it certainly was nothing like, I was attempting to read Atlas Shrugged. I made it to around page 280. And it was just, you know, back to your books, Ayn Rand didn't have any kids. So, you know, it's like, I don't really want to dive too deeply into her at this moment. So, with the book Almost, it was your sort of metaphor prowess, or what have you, the way you spoke of, especially the fact that you were able to make points that weren't in favor of, like, just, you know, like obeying, you know, like rank hypocrites in the military, etc. Like, there's some quotes that kind of stick out to me that really help me derangle, you know, certain, like, emotional wounds from the past, if you will. So it's very helpful. That part of the book was particularly memorably helpful in many ways. So
I always aim to sort of have these electric brushes up with other souls of like intimate thoughts. Like the deeper I go within myself, the closer I think I connect with others through this kind of work. So, okay. So I appreciate that. And obviously, if you prefer it to Atlas Shrugged, well, for me, there's almost no higher praise. And I really do appreciate that. And so, yeah, what was your thoughts on the book, The Future?
Oh, the book, The Future, my thoughts on that were, there's a lot to fight, formally for me, there was a lot more to fight, for that to be, excuse me for the background noise, but for that to have been, for instance, that book has really helped me in ways I haven't currently defined, but it's just, or maybe I don't even need to, but I think, it kind of, a part of me was like, if someone on the internet who I never met in person, whatever, if they can do all this good for me, what can I do good for others, at least to some extent, to some people? So, if they're out there, it surprised, especially the imagery you have for the book is actually superb. It really kind of, it's like, if someone is like, it's to me, at least, my thoughts are, if someone's plotting to be like, be some kind of like demonic force in some kind of sense, just looking at the cover of that book is sort of like, whoa, like, holy crap. It's kind of like, it's a way to sort of ward away the vampires. I really wish it was easy to get a physical version of that book. I've even tried to get, like physical versions of my own books. At this point, it's hard to do, but in terms of the future, there's a lot of ways that book will help, and I'm so glad you're back on X. I've said this a lot of times, so I just want to congratulate you for whatever you did to get, however you get back on X, whatever you talked about. I don't want to bring up rants and stuff, but yeah, the book The Future was very great. It was very for me. At the time, especially when so many people were like getting high or doing degenerate things or like, planning to, do meth or whatever else, those kinds of people, like junkies and all that stuff, it's like, well, you can sort of, try to fit in, or you can just listen to a book that's like, well, maybe something better will come forth about when after, all the aftermath of whatever, from this point. So, it kind of helped me think about, and I started, thinking about, just like, well, what's the point of just collecting government money or whatever else when all these problems are happening and I'm somewhat contributing to the problem. And so I started to look inwardly, started to think more about objectively what I can do in my own life instead of the past and all the history and trying to like correct this and that and whatever else. So it really helped me focus on, the fact that I have my own descendant and the fact that I have to, if I want to be a man of principle, I got to it's not about theory and, it's more about practice. So that's sort of the stuff that it helped me adjust the way that I fight the excuses, because before I used to fight the excuses by whatever, I'll just go for a walk or do something random or work out a lot or go for a run or something. Of course, I still work out. I lift heavy weights more than I do most of any other physical exercise. But the book The Future there's a lot of different ways. I'll just say this is the last thing I'll leave you with, because I don't want to I don't know where everyone else is, but in this conversation. But the last thing I just want to say is that if you haven't at least listened to the book The Future, listen to it. And everyone who claims to love, respect, admire the possibility of the future in terms, childhood, anti-childism, at least that they're not just putting on a front, they'll actually listen to the book. And if they disagree with content in the book, they will vocalize, they will write about it, they will rebut it, they will review it. That's fine. We can have a conversation in the present. That's kind of the point of, I think, anyway, I don't want to speak for Stefan, but I think that's kind of the point of chats like this, is so that we don't have to just, all pretend each other is, obsolete or something. So, I'll just leave it at that for now. But I would like to just hear what your thoughts are on that.
I appreciate that. And look, it's completely wonderful to me as a writer that the work that I've done has had practical impact in your life. Like, I think of a lot of the novels that I've read, and they're entertaining and they're engaging and they give me insights and have cool characters, great dialogue. And this is not to diss any other writers, but one of the reasons that I wrote books was I was really frustrated at the lack of practicality in people's novels. How can you actually use this information to become a better person? And I don't just mean like more in touch with people and more open and intimate. I mean like moral, like you can become a morally better person. And so we are naturally drawn to grand stories, right? If you think of superhero movies, and I'm always a sucker for a Superman movie, God help me. But we're always drawn to these very large narratives, but those large narratives tend to dwarf us. You can hear me or you cannot hear me. So my goal as a writer was to give people practical applications, and drawing people in with grand themes is really important, right? So of course, in my novel Revolutions, there's the lead up to the Russian Revolution. In my novel Just Poor, there's the agricultural revolution, big grand movements of capital and labor and people. And of course, in my novel Almost, this is a German family and a British family from World War I to World War II, massive span. My novel, The Future, of course, is an evil politician who's frozen, comes to life in the future and is put on trial. It's all the vengeance that we want against corrupt politicians in the here and now, but we had to wait 500 years to get it. And also a very controversial use of violence in the protection of children, called the Angels, which you can read about in the novels. Very, very important stuff. And obviously, some of it's quite shocking, but all, at least to my mind, morally defensible. So in all of my novels, though, I'm looking at the very early origins of the larger themes in the world. Because we can't fix the larger themes in the world directly, but we can improve people's childhoods. We can improve parenting. So even in a huge continent-spanning novel that's like basically three novels called Almost, it comes back to childhood. And in my novel The Future, you can't get a free world until you fix abusive parenting. And the fixing of abusive parenting is itself quite brutal. And that's important. And generally, it would be, right? So I do want big grand themes. They're exciting. They're exhilarating. But I also want the details in how we live, and in particularly how we parent, and how that influences, right? So there's no particular spoilers. There's a very evil character in my novel, The Future, and his evil is very hard to understand until you learn about his childhood. Now, this is not to say it's all determinism. There are still choices to be made, but the great evils in the world come out of the small evils in the home, or rather to say, the great evils in the home produce all the evils in the world. And that really is the goal of what it is that I'm aiming to achieve. And the fact that people have read my novels, even something as abstract and futuristic as my novel, The Future, and have found practical, useful applications out of it is exactly what I'm looking for. So I thank you for that feedback. You can get these books, of course, at freedomain.com/books. They're free, and I hope that you will avail yourself of them. Honestly, just give it a try. Listen to the first, few minutes. Listen to the first 5 or 10 minutes of one of my novels and see. I actually just recorded a chapter of my new novel, which I'm working on at the moment, when I can, and I will be putting that out so that you can get a sense of the kind of writing that I'm doing now, which is, I'm always trying something different and new with every book. It's how I keep myself interested, and I think how I keep my creative juices flowing. So thanks everyone for dropping by. I really do appreciate it. I'm sorry if you had any technical issues hearing, but of course it's all recorded here locally, at least my part. So freedomain.com/donate to help out the show. I really would appreciate that enormously, humbly, gratefully and deeply. And also you can go to fdrurl.com/locals to sign up for a subscription. And through that, you get access to just some really wonderful and amazing goodies. We've trained a whole bunch of different AIs on, you know, thousands of hours and hundreds of pages of my material. It's multilingual, so if English isn't your first language, you can still get the benefits of the philosophical approach that I take through the AIs. 12 hours on the history of the French Revolution and the meaning behind it. There is a 22-part History of Philosophers series, which is some of my greatest work, and hundreds of premium shows that are a little bit too spicy for the mainstream. So I hope you will check that out at fdrurl.com/locals. All right, my friends, thank you for a glorious afternoon of philosophical chatting, and we will talk to you Wednesday night for a Wednesday Night Live. All the best. Bye.